This week on Behind the Lens. Following the story of grade inflation at John F. Kennedy High School, email communication shows school administrators scrambling to confirm students' graduation eligibility even after graduation day. And a former dump site is being considered for a high school football field in a possible land swap between the Orleans Parish School Board and the Housing Authority of New Orleans. Marta Jewson will have the details. Also, a year after Mayor LaToya Cantrell created New Orleans' Gun Violence Reduction Task Force, a lack of information and transparency about the program has some criminal justice and civil rights advocates concerned. Michael Isaac Stein will join me. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
Students and administrators are still grappling with the fallout from an investigation into grade inflation at John F. Kennedy High School weeks after senior class graduation. Marta Jewson joins me now. Marta, your reporting uncovered some emails between administrators and contractors at the school. What did you find?
After reviewing dozens of emails, we found that this was a really like multifaceted sort of audit that they were doing on students' grades. We can clearly tell there's a scramble going on to ensure that kids got the right amount of credits or took the right classes or if they were missing a test. You can also see that they were calculating grades down to the wire. And then what you start to see in these emails is a little bit of tension emerge between the administrative staff and the contractor that the New Beginnings Charter Group hired to look into the allegations.
What were some of the points of tension in these emails?
You could see a lot of tension between the two groups, the administrators and the contractor, especially in regards to like access to data and who was controlling data. So the contractor is asking for more and more data. The administration is pretty much giving it to them when they want, although there's some miscommunications there. And then the day after graduation, all staff are cut off from PowerSchool, which is the online grade book that the school uses to keep track of grades. And so immediately the principal shoots back and says, can you please explain why we've been cut off from this? We have grades to enter because they weren't due until the day after graduation. And Principal Gibson just really gets no response to that question. And then also we see quite a scramble on graduation day. An email in the morning goes out from the assistant principal to one of the contractors saying she questions the way that they calculated the GPA of the valedictorian and salutatorian. So obviously, that's a pretty big deal if we're unsure about the calculation of two people who are going to give speeches at graduation ceremony that afternoon.
Yeah, not only speeches, but also that position comes with some notoriety that could benefit you going forward in your school career for sure.
Absolutely, with financial help from institutions and then certainly as something on your resume. I mean, that's a badge of honor.
And this review, this audit by this external contractor follows these accusations of grade inflation, giving students a passing grade when perhaps they had failed a class, and the departure of numerous school administrators that you've been following for months now.
Correct. So this all kind of came to light when a former employee stepped up, and actually he initially went to the administration in January, told them that he thought these grade changes from Fs to Ds were suspicious, and asked for a review. Their internal review turned up nothing, but then when we took his story public, the charter school board actually decided to initiate an investigation. The CEO was suspended with pay, and she eventually resigned. And then five other school administrators are no longer with the school.
So this all came to light in the past few months as 168 students were getting ready to graduate. And we continue to learn new information about how this impacted their graduation and potentially could impact their futures.
Right. So when kids walked across the stage on May 17th, they actually got a little slip in their diploma cover that said, OK, come back to school on May 20th for your diploma. That hasn't happened yet. Students are still awaiting their diplomas because the grades are still being audited. And I think what we saw in these emails was that maybe this goes a little deeper than we thought. They were looking at credits from freshman, junior, senior year, some mistakes that had been made. They were also had issues with transfer students. They hadn't properly received their grades. So students who are trying to make their plans for, you know, post-high school are kind of in limbo right now.
And we talked last week about what students told you they were experiencing here a week later after this new information has come out. What are those students thinking and feeling now?
The students tell us that they're still waiting for their transcripts. Obviously, they're just hoping to get accurate, up-to-date information on their A, the validity of their diplomas or whether or not they have them, and then transcript information to give to college. Had one student text me this week and say, wait, we were supposed to get grades for the internships. They read that in our article and, you know, realized that something was a little different in those emails than what they had been told at the school level. So students really just want answers, but at this point it's a lot of hurry up and wait. In these emails, we also were able to figure out that there were at least two students who were told hours before the ceremony that they were not eligible to graduate and wouldn't be walking at graduation. That was another tension point. Principal Brian Gibson was arguing to let a student walk, and the consultant said, you know, we really don't recommend that. That kind of goes against your policy.
And there's a charter board meeting on Saturday, hopefully next week. Everyone will have some more information.
Right. That's what we're hoping for. The board president has promised transparency and to provide answers as quickly as possible at this board meeting on June 8th. Hopefully people are going to learn a lot more.
A proposed deal between the Housing Authority of New Orleans and the Orleans Parish School Board could build football fields at Booker T. Washington High School, a school that sits on the former Silver City dump site. Meanwhile, Hanna would acquire McDonough 7 School, and this has some neighbors up in arms. So Marta Jusen is here to explain what's going on. Marta, there are a lot of players in this story. Who are they?
So this has actually been a really interesting scenario, case of like land use and what people want in their communities. So we have a high school, Booker T. Washington, that clearly wants a football field, an athletic space, something that they've never had. The school board wants to give that to them. And then in another part of town where an old school, McDonough 7, it's very historic, 140-year-old beautiful building that has been a school for the last 140 years, is the neighbors don't want that neighborhood school to go away. So they've actually filed a lawsuit against the school district trying to prevent them from trading that building. So we really have a lot of different kind of tentacles to this potential land swap going on, and they're all very fascinating.
So let's start at Booker T. Washington. That property underwent remediation for lead and mercury contamination. It's been undergoing remediation throughout the last 5 years, and the school is currently being rebuilt.
Right. So the Orleans Parish School Board owned a piece of property that butts up to a Hanno property. The district and the Recovery School District remediated that land before they built the school, which is almost done now, and Booker T. will be in there next fall. Meanwhile, Hanno was doing remediation on the Hanno land. So they tell us they've remediated it to a non-industrial standard. And we have asked the district whether this is, you know, what they want or not. And so we're hoping to hear from them. But kind of that concern there is, you know, is this a safe place for kids to be?
And, you know, whether or not it was Hanno or the school board that remediated the property, there's concerns that the land is not safe. There's lead and mercury in the soil. Environmentalists are concerned about the safety and even issues of environmental racism.
Right. So when they did the remediation at the school site, they removed several feet of soil. They put in a physical barrier and they put soil back in. Some people think that is a fine solution. I think the Department of Environmental Quality said that. And then other people are concerned because they say, yeah, that might be fine for now, but like if there's any flooding in the area or subsidence is becoming an issue, you know, that's going to change the makeup and what people are exposed to, or, you know, if pavement starts cracking. Some environmentalists don't see this as a long-term solution.
And we know in New Orleans this certainly isn't the first or the last school or housing complex to be built on a former dump site.
Right. And I think that's probably where a lot of these concerns come from. And then even potentially what some people might say were elevated concerns come from this history of putting black and brown people on remediated land, or so-called remediated land that we later find out is not remediated. Like that happened in the 80s at Moton Elementary School out in the east. They had to close that school by the mid-90s.
And one person you spoke to for your article, Monique Hardin, she's the Assistant Director of Law and Policy for the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. She was particularly concerned about this land being used as a football field. Why is that different from the school?
Right. So she says the school, at least, when you're building a building, you're probably encapsulating that soil in concrete and you're much less likely to come in contact with it. You know, she actually kind of joked, like, literally the point of a football field is to be in contact with the grass and, you know, in constant contact at practice every day or on games on the weekends. So she really wants to ensure that LDEQ and HANO and the school districts are doing their due diligence here to protect children.
And HANO says that their contractors remediated the land up to Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality standards. Is the school satisfied with that?
So we asked Hardin about that, actually, and she said Louisiana is one of only 17 states that does not have a specific standard for remediation for, like, school or school use properties. So she says we're pretty unique in that way. Obviously, she's not a fan of that. She wants to see a higher level of protection for kids.
Meanwhile, over at McDonough 7, neighbors are concerned about the future of that site under the Housing Authority of New Orleans.
So neighbors of McDonough 7, which is in the Milan neighborhood, they want that school to remain a school. They say that they're worried that under HANO's ownership that it could fall into disrepair. One potential thing HANO might do with that building is convert it to affordable or mixed income apartments. We haven't seen a whole lot of discussion over that yet because HANO kind of says they're just going to wait to make any decisions until they actually own the property, which they don't as of yet. But neighbors say that they don't want it to come into HANO's ownership without a plan. But on the other side of that, the school district says, no, we're the ones who get to decide which buildings we use and when. And this 140-year-old school is not an appropriate building for students anymore. They say it's too old. It would require a lot of repair work. They also say the site is only half the size of the new standards that they have set for property size for schools.
And this has even gone so far as to a lawsuit that's pending.
Right. So the Turo Bolany Neighborhood Association has sued the district, trying to get them to not declare this school as surplus property because that's what would allow it to be swapped or sold to HANO. There was a really interesting hearing on it earlier this week. The neighborhood group in the school district argued in front of Judge Kern Reese in civil district court. Reese was trying to, you know, wade through all of these school policy issues and laws regarding schools and charter schools. For instance, the district, if it declares a building a surplus property, it must offer it to charter schools. So now the district has said that it has done that and that no one is interested in the building. But the Neighborhood Association says you can't do that in the future because we have a charter group that's going to be in McDonough 7 until 2021. So the neighborhood group is arguing you can't declare it surplus when it has a tenant.
So you said students will be at Booker T. Washington for school this fall. When might this all play out between the potential football field and this other school? What kind of timeline are we looking at?
We don't exactly know at the moment. That hearing in court happened in late May, so we're still awaiting a ruling from the judge. But obviously that would have a large impact on whether or not this trade could go through. And then other than that, I think there need to be property appraisals will have to be done before anything officially happens. People have some worry about whether or not the HANO property is actually worth the same amount as the historic McDonough 7 school. If they're not worth the same amount, they would have to, you know, either include more property or include some money. So I think we're definitely talking about months, if not a year, before the swap was finalized.
And in the meantime, students are enrolled for next fall at McDonough 7.
Correct. Audubon Charter School is currently in that building, and they have a lease that goes through the summer of 2021. So there'll still be a school there for two more years at least.
Marta Jusen, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Mayor LaToya Cantrell created New Orleans Gun Violence Reduction Task Force about a year ago. The group has been working to identify individuals that the city deems to be at high risk for involvement in gun crime. The Cantrell administration has been tight-lipped about the program. Michael Isaac Stein's reporting has uncovered some information, and he joins me now. Michael, what is this Gun Violence Reduction Task Force, and what are they trying to do?
Yeah, so like you said, it was created about a year ago, shortly after Mayor Cantrell was elected. And what its main aim has been trying to do, based off of emails that we've obtained, is create a tool that will help the city identify individuals who they deem to be at high risk of being involved in a gun crime. Now, the theory that kind of underlies this, it's something that's been applied in other cities, Chicago probably most notably, but the idea is that the majority of gun crime in any city is concentrated among a very small population. And it's kind of taking this approach to gun violence that it's more of a like an infectious disease almost, that the violence can almost travel and be transmitted through you know, social connections. And so one of another one of these underlying theories is that the same group of people that are most likely to perpetrate a gun crime are also the most likely to be the victims of one. So, you know, what they say about this list of people is that they're identifying people who are at highest risk of being shot. But at the end of the day, that does end up being more or less the same as the group that is most likely to commit a gun crime. So that's kind of the broad overview. And to be perfectly honest, there's not much more detail I can say with high confidence, only because the Cantrell administration has not released that much information about the tool and about the task force. Everything that I've written about, we've written about it twice now, once in October and once this week, has been pulled from emails that we got through public records requests. So, you know, this is our understanding, but, you know, the mayor's office has not commented, not in October and not now. So some of this is still guesswork based off the emails that we're seeing back and forth. What we do know is that the sociologist that they hired, not hired, but signed a CEA with to create this tool has already received data and is already working to create that identification tool.
What are criminal justice advocates that you spoke to worried about when it comes to this program? It seems to me that there's a degree of guilt by association happening.
Yeah, I think the main source of concern comes from the fact that the city has actually tried this before. So if you remember towards kind of the tail end of Mitch Landrieu's administration, it came out that the city had been using a piece of software from a company called Palantir. That was a company founded by Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel that was started with seed money from the CIA, actually. But they created this software that they said could predict who was the most likely to be involved in a gun crime, using a number of different inputs, everything from social media to jailhouse phone logs to arrest records, incident reports, kind of taking all that aggregated data and spitting out, you know, these individuals who were deemed to be at high risk. Now, at the time, there was a pretty big reaction in the city when that came out. The city had been using that software since 2012, and we, you know, most people only found out about it in 2018. So I think that there was some backlash to the secrecy of it. And then I think there was also some concern about how it was being used. One of the things that the software was used for was Mitch Landrieu's, under his administration, he had a program that basically they were called call-ins. So they would take a number of suspected gang members or people at high risk of being involved in a gun crime, and they would kind of bring them all together into a room with both social service providers and law enforcement from the local, state, and federal level. And the idea was to basically give these people a choice, engage with social services, try and, you know, get out of the cycle of violence that you might be in, or if you break the law again, you're going to be targeted for something that they called enhanced enforcement. So basically, you know, we're going to throw the book at you if you get caught again. And in retrospect, you know, it's hard to get super comprehensive data, but the numbers that we do have indicate that the law enforcement side of that program was a little bit more active than the social services side. And I think that is another concern here. Now, from the emails, I mean, they've been very explicit about wanting this program to be different from that. That was definitely a law enforcement-led program. The Gun Crime Reduction Task Force, they would like this to not be law enforcement-led. And at least, you know, in initial emails, the idea was that law enforcement would have a very limited role. But still, there seems to be some confusion on the task force about how involved the police should be. We know that at least two NOPD officers have gone to meetings and have been involved. And I think there's also just a concern that whether or not the NOPD is involved in what the task force is calling social interventions, whether or not they're directly involved in those, the concern is that they could get their hands on this list of people and use that to guide their policing or their investigations. And I think to some criminal justice advocates, that amounts to a kind of predictive policing that punishes people before they may have even committed a crime. So those are kind of the central concerns.
And this whole issue
you know, especially with the fact that information has been hard to come by, seems like it would raise some red flags with groups like the ACLU.
Yeah, I think the opaque nature of the program is certainly the central cause of concern. You know, anytime you're creating a list of individuals, anytime the government is creating a list of individuals, especially when it has to do with crime, and especially when it has to do with predicting crime, you're going to have civil rights concerns. And I think, you know, even the advocates that were most uncomfortable with the program said, listen, there might be a right way to do this, but that would involve engaging the community, ensuring 100% transparency. Otherwise, you know, it's hard to trust, especially given the city's track record. You know, I think the Palantir program and the secrecy surrounding that is just kind of bringing back, you know, some old memories right now.
You wrote another article this week about policy changes by the mayor and other city officials taking a harder stance towards juvenile crime. Could this new effort by the mayor intensify some of the concerns you were talking about?
Yeah. So, this was the second article I wrote this week. It's about a number of different policies that have been announced or advocated for in the past few weeks. And it really, to criminal justice advocates, represents a pretty major heel turn by the Cantrell administration in terms of how they talk about juvenile crime. I think the focus, you know, since she was elected has been on social programming, on healthcare, on education, things like that. And in the past month, it's kind of turned to more of a public safety, criminal justice stance, you know, talking about increasing detention time when a juvenile is arrested, you know, for trying to steal a car, for example. And so I think the concern, going back to the Crime Reduction Task Force, is that the program started out saying that these interventions are not going to be law enforcement led. And I think the concern is that if Cantrell is wavering on that promise and is turning more to a law enforcement focused in order to tackle public safety, then we could see the nature of this program change as well. If this administration is going to go in the direction of a more law enforcement led public safety approach, that could leak over into this program. And now you have a list of individuals in the city that might now be vulnerable to you know, harsher law enforcement tactics.
Following up still on another storyline that you've been reporting for The Lens, dealing with the city's surveillance cameras, a national criminal justice publication, The Appeal, reported on a specific case where police were using those surveillance cameras proactively to sort of stop crime as it's happening, which is not the way the city said originally that they would be used.
Right. Yeah, we had reported on this, I believe it was in December. What they said when the real-time crime monitoring center first went up is that it would be a complaint-based system. So basically, these cameras were going to be running all the time, recording footage, and they were going to store that footage for, you know, 30 days or so. And the idea was that if someone called and reported a crime, then they could go back to the recorded footage, pull it up, and you know, try and either, you know, identify a suspect or get evidence for the prosecution, whatever it may be. Back in December, though, a lawyer at the public defender's office, she was representing a man named Clint Carter. And Clint Carter, he was basically being surveilled by one of these cameras. And we got the footage. You can look at it on thelensnola.org. If you watch the video, it's clear that someone is behind that camera operating it. They're zooming in on people's stoops. It's moving around pretty quickly. It's clear that someone is watching. Basically, what happens next in the video is that it's more or less a drug sting, in that, according to the police report, an undercover officer saw a hand-to-hand interaction, giving a pretense for, you know, three or four police cars to roll up and arrest, you know, a few people. And one of them was Clint Carter. Although they did not find any drugs at the time, the arrest was a violation of Mr. Carter's parole. And the last I heard, he was back in prison for 3 years because of that violation. But the broader concerns that brought up was how the city was using the cameras. Are they using them to actively watch people, or is it more of a passive system? And I think when you look at the Mr. Carter case, you see that at least in one instance, and now this second instance that the appeal reported on, it appears that the city is using it more actively than we thought.
The point to drive home with the situation with Mr. Carter is that the arrest itself was a violation of his parole. That's what landed him back in jail. the arrest happened because of this surveillance situation that may or may not have been above board.
Yeah, I think the case of Mr. Carter illustrates, you know, more than one flaw in the criminal justice system. But when it comes to surveillance specifically, you know, if you look at the police report, it names an undercover officer as the one who was watching Mr. Carter and observed this so-called handoff, this drug handoff. But it doesn't specify where that undercover officer was, right? So he could have been on the scene, or he could have been at the real-time crime monitoring center watching that video, you know, that we posted online. And so that brings up the question of how the police are recording their use of the real-time crime monitoring center and why they wouldn't include that in a police report.
Yeah, there seems to be, throughout all of these topics that we've discussed, a very fine line between reducing crime and protecting people's civil rights. Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next week. And please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.